Well, welcome back to the Summer 2022 Action RC Podcast Series. We're having a great time and glad that you're enjoying listening along. This week, we're mixing it up a little. We are going back for another walk down memory lane for one of Australia's premier electric on-road races of the 90s, particularly the late 90s and 2000s. But we're also going to do something special as we dig into what it takes to design and build a near-perfect replica of arguably the most iconic two-wheel drive world championship winning buggy of all time. That's a personal opinion. The 1989 Masami Hirasaka-driven team associated stealth prototype. That is correct. Today, we are diving deep with Victoria's Andrew Cook, any of the above. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scotty. Thank you so much for this invitation.
It's a delight to chat. And we were just chatting earlier about having not crossed paths for quite a few years. So I'm looking forward to just catching up. We'll get to that wonderful Masami replica eventually, along with some of the other things that you've been designing and building. And that's been capturing some, particularly that Masami replica has been capturing some global attention in that kind of vintage racing and collecting kind of community. So we will get to that. But before we do that, I just really want to dig into your own story and your own history and some of your recollections from along the way. So let's just start where we always do with that obvious first question. How did you get into RC? What did it look like? What was the car? Where were you racing? What's the Andrew Cook RC story?
I spotted an RC car in Maya when we were on holidays.
In Maya? You're the first person to mention Maya. We've had just about everything else, but that's a new one.
Take that one off. It was in Queensland. It was in Queensland. Yeah, we're on holiday with Mum. I think I was about 9 years old at the time, so that was pretty much 1985.
Okay.
And after that, I just nagged and begged Mum constantly for months until she finally caved in to just shut me up. And we headed off to a hobby place in Melbourne.
Yep.
So that was for my 10th birthday present, I think it was. Yeah, at the time, I was obsessed with the Tamiya Superchamp and also the Lamborghini Countach, the on-road one. Looking through the glossy Tamiya catalogs at the time.
But
both of which of those were pretty much out of production by that time.
And, yeah, they would have been a little earlier, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. So behind the performance curve anyway.
Yeah.
So we came out of Hobby Place with a humongous smile on my face and a Tamiya Frog under my arms.
Ah, yes. The mighty frog. The mighty frog.
So the Tamiya Frog was the first one for me. My grandfather helped me build it.
Mm.
Well, actually, he built it and I watched.
Cheating one. Come on, Granddad. Get on with it.
So it actually worked.
Yeah.
So it was all just, playing around in the backyard or local parks at the time, of course. Had no idea that racing existed. And, loved it so much that I think I spent most of the next year nagging my mum for another one.
Okay.
And, I think for my 11th birthday, I got the Tamiya Porsche 956. Know that one, that's the on-road Group C sports car style.
Beautiful.
So next birthday was same thing, exiting Hobby Place with another massive smile on my face and the 956 package deal. So I remember that car was just
they so must have looked forward fast. To that time of year every year at Hobby Place. Oh, here come the cooks. Beautiful.
Have it on their calendar, the big circle on the bay.
That Porsche was such an iconic race car. It full scale, wasn't it, in that era? It's a beautiful car, and a fantastic model.
Yeah, I think it's that and maybe some of the McLaren, McLarens, but the Porsche 956 is quite possibly my favourite car of all time, real and RC. Pretty cool. I remember it was super fast. I mean, For the time and compared to the Frog, of course, it was
relatively speaking.
It was a missile.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had sort of after this time, I had a bit of equipment, two cars and two radios, etc. So what we did was we needed some sort of carry-on, some sort of carry bag.
Hmm.
And so we went for another trip into Maya. I think it was in Doncaster this time, just near us.
Yeah.
Checking out, and the girl that was serving us sort of randomly asked what it was for, And we sort of, so we told her it was, you know, for RC cars. And she sort of just said randomly, oh, I've seen them racing at a little dirt track down in Templestowe.
Okay.
So, yeah, so my mum was sort of, she might have known better later, but oblivious at the time. She said, oh, really? You know, we'll have to go there and have a look. So, yeah, it was definitely the start of something at that moment.
I think, I mean, that's the story that you and I share in common, in that when I pestered my parents into my first RC car, we had no idea racing was a thing either, and we just randomly discovered it later on. So did you get down to Templestowe fairly quickly to have a look and drag that frog out onto the racetrack?
Yeah, I can't remember how many minutes or days, but I'm pretty sure it was pretty quick. Yeah, we went down and had a look. It was the club was called Torc at the time, so TORRCCC, I think it was, as in Templestowe Off-Road Radio Control Car Club.
That would be right. Sounds about right.
Yeah, so I think I was pretty much hooked straight away, started racing the frog.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I remember or whether it was a photograph I remember, but we're, you know, pitting on our picnic mat in the car park at the track. Yeah, got the Magnum Junior, got one of those Tamiya hump pack batteries.
Oh, the mighty hump packs, yes.
Yeah, hooked up to my mum's car battery. A good old Toyota Corona there with the bonnet up.
Oh, my gosh. Now you're just bringing back all the memories. The Corona.
Yep. So, and yeah, so I think pretty quickly we realized that the frog wasn't exactly competitive anymore. Mm. I think I was about probably 86 at that time.
Yep.
Yeah, so yeah, I had already the RC10s and Ultimas and Losis were already a thing. And yeah, Rhys Birtles was the, you know, one of Australia's top racers at that time and a local to the Templestowe Club. Mm. Yeah, so his dad, Jeff, he probably felt sorry for me, just watching me sort of bounce around, literally bouncing around at the back of the field. Yeah, so he arranged a deal through Hobby Place for us for a shiny new RC10, gold pan.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. I think it was maybe 1,200 milliamp NiCad batteries at the time.
That'd be right, yep.
Yep, and yeah, so another trip to Hobby Place, and guess what? another Gigantor smile on my face.
So are you building the cars by this stage, or it's still you sitting down with Grandad to cheer him on while he does the construction?
Yeah, I think I took it on pretty early.
Yeah.
The RC10 I remember building, because the frog I remember I tried to rebuild it once and couldn't quite do it, and then grandfather Jamie had to sort of fix it for me. But yeah, the RC10 I think I was then able to rebuild them and you know, do all my so-called setup and you know, prepare the cars. Mm. I think I was still way at the back of the field, of course, for quite a while. But at least it wasn't, you know, it wasn't due to the car. It was just my own experience and skill at that point.
So just before we kind of leave that moment, Templestowe, I mean, the club exists today in the same location. It's gone, you know, it's obviously an on-road club now, but such a rich history for a club, you know, through that kind of 80s and 90s. And as you say, Jeff and Rhys Birtles were there as some of the key people there. Are there other names that you recall from the club in that era when you first started racing?
When I joined, it's exactly the same location on the corner of the football field there. All, you know, big dirt track. I think there was already a driver stand when I started. It was previously a big telephone pole log or something like that earlier, but I think that was just before my time. Chris Young was the president.
Yeah,
and so he's the father of Clifton Young, who was also one of the top
racers
back then. So he was always, I remember it was like him, Neil Millard, Rhys Birtles, and Davy Crow, Mike Chard. Were pretty much the top of the modified fields at the time.
That's sort of taking us through into the late 80s and early 90s with some of those names.
Yes, definitely.
Michael Chard winning the Nationals in 1991, Davy Crow a year or two later, I think, if I'm remembering things correctly. Some extraordinary talent rolling around that club at that time.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And, yeah, sort of learning from that, I think, Jeff sort of took me under his wing a bit, and he helped me out quite a bit during that period, because I really had zero idea what to do, of course, and it took me a long time to learn
to
a bit and work it out. Yeah.
So what's your, what are your, I guess your recollections then of kind of, you know, increasing competitiveness, you know, and as you, you know, as you go from being a 10 and 11 year old kid with a big smile and a dream to, you know, like obviously you go on to win national championships. So that's quite a journey over that next 10 years. How does the kind of increasing competitiveness, what do you remember of that growth, that journey?
Yeah, it's a good question. Because, like, I think it took me a long time. Like, generally not a sort of fast learner. I just go through it sort of gradually and probably learn from all the errors. So making all the errors that could possibly be imagined. I was racing quite a bit. So they had alternate race meetings at Templestowe and Knox in those days.
Okay. Yep.
I think it's still the same, actually. Like, first and third and second and fourth Sundays of the month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So every Sunday I was racing. Early on, I don't think I was doing much practice or testing. It was just the race days.
Just race days.
Yeah. So, over many years, we did the Yorkshire Shields as well.
Yep.
So we traveled around the States quite a bit back then. So, yeah, Mum drove me around all over the place to not just, you know, Templestowe, Knox, Keilor and Melton, but we also went for the you know, the country ones such as, I think it was Bendigo, Shepparton, Warrnambool. I remember I went to at least once.
All over.
Yeah. There's probably a few others, but, yeah, they're the ones I remember.
So I think I might just butt in there because I have a bad habit of letting acronyms go through unchecked. But just for anyone who might not remember that acronym ORCA that we just used there, that was the Off-Road RC Association, and there was an Australian kind of umbrella organisation, and then each state had its kind of local. So that's the ORCA Victoria series that you're talking about there. There were similar series in other states under other names, but at that stage, ORCA was the national body for off-road RC.
Yeah, that's cool. If you'd asked me, I wouldn't have known what that stood for, actually.
I have a lot of useless information tucked away, Andrew, a lot of useless information. Okay. So you're kind of traveling around, you're getting, you know, slowly kind of figuring it out.
I think in off-road, I don't really remember any sort of big wins. I think there was a couple of invitationals where all of the really good guys were, you know, invited into their own invitational class, like a pro-am, I think it was, or an invitational event. And yeah, so the rest of us had an actual chance of the podium. So I think I won maybe one of those in the tour drive stock class in Victoria. Yeah. But yeah, not too many. Like getting reasonable, but not up the front of the state or national level at that point. I think it wasn't until sort of on-road started to emerge in Victoria and Australia in the early 90s.
Yeah.
There was a track created out at Melton.
Okay.
I think originally it was near their off-road track, and then a little bit later on it was set up in the corner of the car park. So I remember there was a KFC and some, you know, shops, which were always closed, of course, on a Sunday.
Yeah.
in the corner of the car park there in Melton. Just off the freeway. So, yeah, so raced there pretty much predominantly from probably 91 onwards.
So what's that look like? What sort of on-road racing are we talking about there?
Yeah, so this was all Pro 10.
Yeah, okay.
Pretty much primarily Pro 10. There was a few sketchy F1s floating around, which were mostly custom builds at the time.
Yeah.
Not too much rules, so they were quite varied. But, yeah, the primary classes were Pro 10 with stock or modified. So I think stock was maybe a 27 turn, same as off-road.
Yeah.
And then modified, of course, was whatever you could try and make runtime with the batteries.
With the batteries of the day.
Yeah.
Did you get into modified fairly quickly or did you run stock for a while?
I think I'd already gone into modified and off-road.
Okay.
And, yeah, so I went straight to modified and on-road and racing at the time for Greg Collings.
Okay.
So he had a company called Performance Hobby Suppliers. And I think a lot of people will be familiar with him that raced at the time. He did a lot of importing of cars and battery matching and a lot of motors. So we had hyperdrives.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Yeah. So original hyperdrives came out with a belt drive from the pinion to the spur.
They did. That was very unique, wasn't it, in the day?
Yeah. It didn't last very long, but it was unique.
Yeah, we're carefully not saying it was good. We're just saying it was
No,
unique.
yeah, it was definitely unique. I think that one of the first mods was to just put the standard pinion and spur back on them. But yeah, that was a very good car. So like tri-shock and sort of beam front end. So
So,
yeah.
what is it that captured you about on-road? Is it, I mean, you've talked about that Porsche 956 being, perhaps your favorite race car of all time. Is it that? Is it just that full-scale kind of motorsport was something that you've always loved, and so the chance to do that in miniature was the thing, or did you just really love the way the cars worked, or what kind of captured you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I really can't pinpoint a specific attraction. It just was. I think it was whether I was, a bit older at the time, so a bit better at preparing the cars. So I kind of instantly was performing better or getting better results. That might have been part of it. But I think even aside from that, I just, for whatever reason, and yeah, enjoyed it more. It just attracted me for some innate reason.
So at what point do you start traveling then to, or looking at the sort of the national championship and state championship sorts of things? If I'm following a
Well,
timeline, we're sort of into that early to mid 90s kind of period
yeah,
now.
it was probably a bit later than that actually. So yeah, mid-90s. So it was probably we'll get to, I guess, about 98 was were really the traveling or the international traveling. Yeah, so I think all the mid-90s was mostly in Victoria. I can't even remember traveling much interstate for on roads at that time. Yeah, sort of just racing for Greg. We did a lot of most of the racing out of Melton. I think at that time the Templestowe track actually was changed so that it was both off-road and on-road.
Yeah, it was both
So
for a period, wasn't it?
the original track was sort of sliced in half and the driver's stand was rebuilt across the sort of center of where the original track was, which is right in the middle. And then the lower half was the off-road, like a completely different off-road track. And then the upper half was a small on-road track. So yeah, that was most of the racing at the time. So I think during that period, I really started to, sort of learn or, got to that learning curve point where, I was a bit more on top of it, doing a lot more testing and practice and, I was getting sort of towards the pointy end, not quite at the max level at that stage, but, a lot of sort of state level, A finals and podiums at that stage. Yeah, and really Greg was probably a driving force there. Teaching me all about the sort of attention to detail and relentless focus on trying to maximize every little aspect of the car and equipment. And a bit of the psychological aspects as well, I think, came into it in terms of an actual treating it like a sport, a little bit more professional. I remember Greg told me the story, which has always stuck in my mind. It was the Nationals for Pro 10, and it was at the Melton track. I think it was about 92, maybe 93. And in those days, it was pretty common practice to have a practice final or a pre-final between the qualifying and the actual finals.
Yes,
Not quite
checking
sure why, but
everybody's. Oh, it was, well,
yeah.
it's all to do with frequency clashes, is how it
Oh,
used to
yep.
be. My recollection that we'd give everyone a chance to make sure we're all on the right frequencies and there were no glitching issues and those sorts of
Yeah,
things.
good old crystals.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So I remember him telling me, like, he, I think he was on pole. He was either on pole or second. I think he was on pole. And then I think it was Rick Bartolozzi, maybe, that was on second. And they were very close. They were pushing each other all throughout the qualifying. And so, yeah. So what Greg did was he put his absolute best battery and best motor in for that practice final. So the practice final obviously doesn't count for anything, not towards the results. And at that time, remember the batteries, you could only really use them once a day for their best
Yes,
performance, and you had to
absolutely.
put them away, put little resistors on them, or all that sort of stuff. So he put his absolute best equipment in just for the practice final. So what he did was he went out and he absolutely, dominated that practice race. Just drove away from Rick and the rest of the field. And at that point, Rick sort of was, I think it was Rick. Hopefully, I'm not doing him somebody else a disservice, but I'm doing him a disservice. But so like was just forlorn after that practice final. Sort of walked off the stands like, oh, I'm never going to win. I'm never going to compete with that. So at that point, he basically won the event. And then, yeah, he just went on and sort of didn't completely dominate, but he pulled away and, won the finals quite easily. And, the passion maybe from the second guy and the rest were just not there to say, well, we've got no chance of winning. So, yeah, that was sort of something that stuck with
Yeah,
me. I mean, it was a
interesting.
very specific sort of
Yeah,
circumstance, but
yes.
that mentality, that approach of, in a sort of positive way, just taking the psychological aspect to work on your side as well is a very interesting part of it.
So I want to come back to that, because I want to ask you a bit more about that psychology of racing, and as it pertains to your own racing. But it is just worth, I think, just remarking on Greg Colling. So often when we hear his name in this series of podcasts, it's been around the performance hobby supplies kind of side of things, running the team, being a significant figure in the industry. But you've reminded me that he was a very good driver in his own right, and as early as, oh, look, I think as early as around 1984, maybe, he was on a podium at the 12 scale nationals up here in Queensland at Mount Ommaney. I first encountered him in off-road racing, and had some really, really close racing with him right at the front of one of the New South Wales championships we were both at. And, he really was a very good driver, as well as being, that kind of team and industry figure. So yeah, one of the great names, from that 80s into the mid 90s periods in our sport. Greg Collings, the Victorian. Yeah, so that's thank you for the story. It's a great story, and it's a good reminder about Greg. So just maybe talk to me a little bit more about that psychology then, and we'll get to some specific races in a minute, but I'm just curious about how that continued to be a part of your racing, that in terms of preparation and approach and thinking about the people that you're racing against, and maybe those sorts of games that always go on, of the last practice run on Friday afternoon and all of that kind of jazz. What has the psychology of it all meant to you over the years?
Yeah, getting that fast lap in practice and telling everybody about
Yes,
it.
absolutely.
A little bit. Firstly, you've got to perform to your maximum, and then you've got to sort of beat everybody else as well. But if you don't perform to your maximum, then you're not going to be winning in most cases. But I think that inclusive, but the absolute sort of attention to detail on every different aspect. You got the cars, you got the motors, all your spares, your setup, and psychology, but also things like sort of getting rest, sleeping, traveling, eating, all of those sort of things. I don't always do it to the best, but the intention is there to try and get it all right, because I know for myself and probably most. If I'm tired, and especially over a race weekend, which can be 3 or 4, like a big event, can be 3 or 4 days long, you're okay on sort of day one and two, and you're getting more and more run down and tired. And by the finals on Sunday, you're not performing to your best because you're just tired. So, it doesn't matter how good the rest of your preparation and your car setup and your performance is, if you can't focus and drive to your best, nothing else sort of matters. So, just all the little details like that, I try and sort of focus on, and maximize them all. Not go, oh, I've got the best motor and then that's enough, or I've got brand new batteries, that should be enough. If I'm exhausted or haven't eaten properly, it doesn't matter how good the motor is. So I think that's really something I've tried to always
All the one percenters.
follow.
Yeah.
Every little bit counts.
Well, certainly we've heard some incredible stories out of, I'm just thinking about the Formula One world, and actually thinking about a story about Nico Rosberg from his championship year, about the incredible length and detail that he went to in his battle within the team with Lewis Hamilton. And I think it was a story about him having some driving gloves especially made that were seamless, so that even just the tiniest little detail of the feeling of a seam against his finger would not be there to be a distraction. That the just the depth of detail that he went to in that battle, and it's I think it's a truism that same thing can be in RC, that the more we think about these tiny little details and getting them all right, that can all play into the results.
Yeah, for sure. Because at that level, a lot of us can be very, very similar. We've all got very similar equipment. We've all got a similar setup by that point in the race event, and basically all our skill is pretty similar. So then at that point, it comes down to those little things. It might come down to the nerves or the mindset going into it. Are you relaxed and fed, and confident in all your preparation. You know you've done everything right. If somebody beats you on the day and you've done everything you could, then, so be it. They're just better. Congratulations. Sort
yes,
of thing.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, they deserve it because they've done all those things just as good or just that fraction better than you. So, at that point you go, right, I've done everything I can. I finished first, second, third, fourth, doesn't matter. It's, you've maximized it. If you're fortunate on the day and you have done the best of everybody, then you might get the win.
Yeah. So we're now into the sort of mid to late 80s, and this is really the high point, as I recall, 90s. of that 90, sorry, of that Pro 10 era. We're getting to a point now where batteries are becoming less of an issue. What was it like driving those? I mean, they're rocket ships, right? Those Pro 10 cars with decent batteries. Yeah. And what were they like to drive, Andrew?
Oh, I love them. It's easily my favorite class of all time.
Yeah.
12 scale is my next favorite after that, if there's no Pro 10. But Pro 10 is and always will be my favorite RC class. It's like they're obviously so fast. You've got heaps of downforce, big wide rear tires with the foams. Mm. The cars look like the chassis look quite simple, but that in effect makes them very complex as well to get right. So very, very sensitive, very delicate, as in, a couple of tenths setting out, it's going to affect the performance quite significantly. Just all that sort of stuff I think there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And when you get it right and, you just, the car feels like it's on, like a slot car, like it's on rails. If you're driving it well and, even if you have by yourself on the racetrack or in a really good race with somebody, just the feeling of all that hooking up and working to its maximum is nothing better. I find. Yeah,
and I imagine that it's been a long time since I've driven Pro 10, so I'm struggling to remember. But I guess my recollection is that the harder and the faster you drove the cars, the better they worked. Partly around the downforce, the higher the speed, the more grip you tended to get. Am I remembering that right?
Oh, pretty much. Yeah, definitely. Was it the downforce? Is it downforce squares with speed or the drag or something? But at their speed, like on a small little tight track, they'll still work, but definitely not as good. But on a high speed track with fast corners, they really come alive for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
So we get to 1998, and the Nationals comes to town, to hometown at Lilydale for you. I've heard little snippets of that event in a conversation with Andrew Abbott a little while back, and I'd encourage listeners to go kind of digging into Andrew's story. He was probably arriving on the scene a couple of years after you. But what's the story of 1998 at Lilydale in Pro 10 for you? What do you recall about that event?
Oh, yeah, that was fantastic. Yeah, Andrew and I did a lot of racing together and travelled a lot together as well over the years. We had a really good really good friendship and really good battles on track back then. Lilydale track is basically an 8-scale gas car track. So it's large, super long straight. I think it was about 60 plus meters long.
Wow, okay.
Big sort of sweeping, tightening, banked corner at the end of the straight. Super fast, like perfect for Pro 10. I really can't remember the motors and batteries we were using. I think it was 2,000 milliamps at that time. Motors would have been probably an 8 or 9 turn. I reckon we would have been running probably a 9. At that track, we sort of added a few wines.
Okay.
In both the touring cars and the Pro 10 were running then. So touring cars had emerged and they were a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was all foam tires for touring cars as well. And I was racing for Barry Putty at the time.
Oz Charge
Electronics. I've got a Baz in the can. So it was him. I'm not sure if he was actually at that Nationals, but Justin Begunst and myself were both running for Barry in terms of touring cars.
Yep. So, the famed FSR Bullet.
Bullet, yes.
That's right.
That was an awesome car, that one. Love that. Yes, FSR Bullet, GM Electronics, I think it was the whole deal, like batteries, motors, and speedy and charger, and everything was all GM. Yeah. Yeah, so running that. But then, yeah, the Pro 10, I was running an associated RC10 L2 also.
L2 is what I've got in the national kind of charts.
Awesome.
An
let's go with that.
Yeah. So that's right. Let's assume the spreadsheet's correct.
Yep. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that was, that was a great cool car. And over the years, a mate of mine, well, actually a good mate of Greg Collins, Alan Tuffer, he has started racing probably the early 80s before almost everyone else here, I think. And yeah, he started off in 12 scale out at was it Ringwood car park track, and on and off he would basically be the race engineer for Greg, and then later on, don't know how it happened, but he started to sort of be the the friend race engineer for myself.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was setting up and preparing the Pro 10 car, and then I was doing the touring car. So the Pro 10 Nationals was pretty much all him. I was just steering the thing. So he needs the majority of the credit for that one. For sure. Yeah, so we're battling with Andrew Abbott in Pro 10. So we were pretty much sort of neck and neck through the qualifying. And I think towards the end of the qualifying, Al was kept tuning and, pushing every little bit out of the car. And we're getting a slight advantage, I think, in qualifying. So I got TQ. And then, the finals was, it was pretty much nose to tail. And I think by that time my car was just that little bit better, like a bit more stable. Al had, just tuned it
magic.
Just that bit more. And I was able to be a bit more confident, bit more consistent on the throttle. And I just remember I was sort of just gradually pulling away from Andrew, literally a car length or two a lap, not much. And just towards the end, I can't remember if it was the first final or second final, but he just trying to catch me, sort of too much throttle coming out of the corner, and looped it round a bit. And that was it.
That was enough.
So it was, that was some epic races.
Yeah.
some of the best. It was just the two of us pretty much out the front. I think third was quite a distance behind. But, just the racing we had together was pretty awesome. So, made it very enjoyable and satisfying to win that one. Yeah, which, as you said, was the first Nationals that I won.
I've got, just while we're on that, I've got, yourself and then Abbott, both of you running the L2, and then Stuart Grant actually finishing on the podium as well, running
Stewie,
the Trinity car, I think. A Trinity, so would that have been a Switchblade?
Switchblade,
something like that. Yeah, so Stuart, obviously one of the all-time, legends in the sport in Australia.
Awesome
on the podium
driver.
Again at the Nationals just a few weeks ago. Something like 40.
It's
40
scale, was it?
That's right. Yeah. 40 years down the track from, when he first started winning, still doing the business. So maybe one day I'll get a chance to chat with Stuart on this podcast. That would be amazing. But that's the podium in Pro 10. Touring car, you're up against Justin Vergunst and
Darren
Campbell,
I think,
who's running that Losi, the new street weapon at the time. Any recollection from the touring car side of things?
So just now we're running the FSR Bullets, but we'd sort of figured out a way to, for that track specific, I think, definitely, we'd figured out a bit of a trick with the electronics in the transmitter. Well, I still delude myself that it was an advantage.
I'm all ears at this point. I want to know what's going on here.
It was our super super secret, like it was type of a turbo boost sort of effect.
Okay.
We dubbed it Voodoo.
Voodoo.
And it's probably back to this psychological thing a bit, actually.
Yeah.
We sort of let a few words, it was like probably Darren and Stewie and that sort of overhear us. Accidentally, deliberately talking about his voodoo. Basically psyched them out with that. Because what we had actually worked out was that a higher wind motor, so more turns on the motor, was actually a lot better for that track.
Okay.
I think they were running probably 9 or 10 turn motors in the touring car.
Yeah.
For that big, massive track, we found the 13 turn was actually a lot sort of quicker and more efficient. Because I'm pretty sure throughout that meeting, you know, Darren and that were struggling with runtime. With the 10 turn. So we were sort of setting our transmitters at 80 or 90% throttle, like sort of EPA kind of thing.
Okay.
And then we had like a magic override button, which would kick it up to, you know, 100%.
So this is wonderful. Andrew. I love it.
I really don't think it's actually better than, you know, just driving smoother. We thought it was good at the time. And it, you know, at that point, it was effective for us.
Yeah. Well, that's right. If you feel good about what you're driving, then you feel good about what you're driving. So
yeah, and all the others thought we had some special secret, which was pretty much just a slower motor, effectively, which was slower, but, you know, less torque, but more RPM. So yeah, we were rocket ships down the straight, and I don't know what the gaps were, but I remember we sort of were pulling away from third and behind quite a lot. So it was pretty much a battle between Justin and myself of, you know, who could just eke out that few extra meters of battery and not, you know, not go as soft in the last lap. And I think Justin got TQ, I was second, and Darren, third on the grid, I think. And it was pretty much a battle, like Justin and I would just stay close. Well, I'd just try and stay close to him for the whole race and try and conserve that battery power for the last lap was the game. And we both our cars sort of slowed a fraction, you know, coming onto that last lap. And you're just trying to sort of feather the throttle.
Just to get it home. Yeah.
Yeah, just not get it sideways, not scrub off any speed. And I think at least two of the finals, we were literally crawling around the last corner. And the loop was about 2 meters out of the last corner. Yeah, it must have looked pretty ridiculous. we're probably, you know, half a lap or a lap up on the rest. It was a big, big distance. We might have even been sort of got over the line for the last lap, but the others missed out. And we're like literally crawling across the line, trying to keep the cars straight, because at that point the servos would stop performing too well as well. The battery's almost dumped. There's no cutoff at that time. So I think he won the first final. I might have won the second.
Yeah.
And then, it was the same again. It was just crawling over the line in the third, but he just hung on. It was probably a meter or two in it.
He's such an interesting character, Justin, and I don't know him well, but it's not the first time he's come up in this podcast series of someone who's really worked. I think there was a story from an off-road nationals around 2000 with an oil track and the way that he had worked out how to make the tires be at their best. And he really was a guy who really thought very carefully about what he was doing on the racetrack, wasn't he? And clearly a very good driver as well.
Definitely. And especially in setup. Yeah. He was quite a guru at the setup. I learned a massive amount from him. I wouldn't have been anywhere near him at that event without his help, and because we'd always practice and race together before. Mm. So his like shock setup and tuning and just sort of doing little small modifications to the cars or the FSR at that time. Pretty clever. Yep.
Yeah, nice. The other thing I just want to ask you about, I guess on the topic of that event, but it probably happened multiple times over your time. What's it like going from Pro 10 to touring car and back on the same day in the same final series? Those cars must have been so different to drive. How did that work for you?
Yeah, well, in terms of driving back then, both the cars were on foam tires.
Yeah.
So my recollection is that they weren't actually as different as what it would be today.
Okay.
Both both essentially batteries. I was going to say two cell, both six cell batteries. Same sort of motor lines, you know, pretty similar between them, and both foam tires. So the main difference was just the extra downforce of the Pro 10s. I really don't remember them being that
bad.
Different. A lot more recent of struggle. If I try and do two cars in the same day or same meeting, I can't. Yeah, just can't sort of switch the mindset. You can do them both reasonably well, but not to 100% for either of them. Yep. So, yeah, they both suffer sort of thing. But, yeah, back then I don't remember it being an issue.
It might – I mean, I'm careful to who I say this to, but there might also be an age factor there, Andrew, for those of us who started in the mid-80s.
I was thinking that.
Now, you and I are in danger of going for hours and hours here, so I'll keep us moving forward.
Yep.
But I want to just kind of detour overseas at this moment, because we're in 1998 and this is the time at which you start doing some overseas races. So just talk to us a little bit about the Kyosho and Tamiya world finals that you did, and then, you know, a trip to New Zealand, I think, and then maybe some worlds things. But let's start with those Kyosho and Tamiya, those, you know, wonderful era of those companies running their own kind of global race series and an international final. And I think you were involved in both of those. So let's start with the Kyosho one. You know, how'd you get into that? What was that experience like? And maybe reflect on the Tamiya experience as well.
Oh, yes, they were spectacular events and amazing that those companies, sort of sponsored and paid for them, you know, promoted and ran those things at the time. Yeah, I feel super fortunate that, you know, I was racing and racing well at that point and had those opportunities. I think I was working at Hobby Place with BJ, Bain and Louie. At
so
that
after
time,
all those years of going in and buying a car every year on your birthday, you end up,
yep.
Okay, gotcha.
I had to recover some of the money. Although that's that didn't really work because, you know,
no,
you basically
spend more money. Yeah.
Yeah. You're yeah. saying, oh, I want one
Sorry,
of those.
And I've then, distracted
there goes,
you. I just
there
thought
goes
that's
the pay.
That's a beautiful moment for you to be back where it all began.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. So, yeah, working there with Ron Luke and BJ. So at that time, yeah, was when the Kyosho Cup started to be promoted and Hobby Place was selling lots of the Kyosho cars. The Pure Tens were the ones that were used for that event.
Yep.
Yeah. So they were, oh, I can't remember what it was. It was basically like a touring car, obviously gas-powered, little pretty low-powered motors. Can't remember what they were, maybe 0.12s or 0.15s.
Yeah.
So at the time, yeah, so BJ and I decided to team up and go in the, I think there was state and then national finals for it. And then the winner of the nationals would get the all expenses paid sort of, you know, luxury style trip over to the World Cup, wherever that was being held. The first time we went in it, we did okay. I think we're about third or fourth or something at the nationals. So yeah, did win. And then the next year we went up to Moorbank for the final.
Okay.
And we got second, and there was quite a lot of shenanigans after the race where the winner's car seemed to have an illegal modification to the header pipe, I think it was. So then they were trying to screw in the arrow car, and then they couldn't get the damn head off the engine because we'd loctited it too much.
Okay.
So it was just like a big debacle. Yeah, they couldn't screw in the arrow car, and they're like, you know, why can't we get it off? Did you glue it on so you're hiding all your secrets in there? So in the end, they just gave up, and I think all the results just stood, so we missed out again. And then the time after that, I teamed up with Justin, and this time there's also Lou Solar and Simon Bedisi were racing as well. And yeah, so myself and Justin, we raced sort of under the banner of Hobby Place as well.
Okay.
And I think the final was in Canberra, the old Canberra track, the old site. And we won the Nationals, and Simon and Lou were second.
Okay.
And yeah.
Oh, so was it a two? So hang on. Oh, now I think I'm just checking that I might have misunderstood. Was it a two person, two driver kind of a team format?
Yes, it was.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the finals were an hour long.
Right.
And, yeah, you'd have to have two,
oh, that's very
two
cool.
drivers per team.
Yeah.
So I can't remember how we did that. I think sort of basically the other person would be doing the fuel stops and then, you know, sort of run up and swap over transmitters, and we probably had to drive at least a third of the race each, sort of at minimum. So there was two teams. And I can't remember exactly what happened, but basically the first two finishes in that event got to go, won the trip to the World Cup. And luckily for us, that was in Hawaii.
Oh, no. How terrible.
So we had to slam it, all expenses paid, at a luxury hotel in Honolulu on the beach there.
Wow.
So that was unbelievably spectacular. Yeah.
just before we go off from that, I literally just ran in a team enduro on the week a couple of weeks ago at Chargers in Brisbane, an end of season 2-hour off-road endurance race, and it just struck me that is such an unusual, rare opportunity to race as a team. And so now you're telling me this story about the Kyosho Cup. It is a different kind of a racing than, we do almost any other time, isn't it? To work with another driver to figure out how to make the car work for both of you and what you need to get out of each other and out of the car.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
really
totally different.
unique.
A bit more like real racing, I guess,
Yeah.
where there's often two drivers in the team and the whole team around them. So yeah. Yep. And you got to like have a car that, both of you can drive, and it has to be
That's
the,
right.
the same transmitter. So you both got to get used to that, and the setup has to be a balance or a compromise between you.
Yeah. And well, of course, you've got to know where the voodoo button is as well.
Oh yeah.
So
Don't tell
how did
anyone.
that Hawaii race go when you went to the Worlds? What was that experience like?
Oh, it was phenomenal. Like the way that Kyosha looked after us was just amazing. Really nice hotel, awesome food. That they were just so happy that everyone was there, and running, racing their cars and being involved, and they were sort of thanking us, where we're thinking, what are you talking about? We need to
That's
thank you. So yeah, it was very enjoyable. The racing, Simon and Lou did better than us, I think. They didn't make it to the A, but got pretty close. We had quite a few crashes and incidents, so I think early on in the event we were up there, but we gradually sort of dropped back, and there was a bit of controversy around the tire inserts as well, at that event, because it was meant to be sort of all done in good jest, and everybody cooperating, and you had to use all the standard items, standard inserts, but it came out that some of the top teams were not following those rules, and nothing much was done about it. So it was a bit.
That is the downside of spec racing, isn't it? That people do really kind of push the limits when everything is tightly controlled. People push the limits to find that tiny little advantage.
Yeah, it's sort of a bit disappointing, but I mean, it's human instinct, I suppose, to find that advantage or to push the limits. It's just whether it's a bit over the line or just inside the line, I guess.
And then
But yeah, it was amazing.
the Tamiya World Cup as well, or the Tamiya Cup, I think it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah, Tamiya
What's the
Cup. Yeah,
Tamiya
Tamiya World
story?
Cup. Yeah. So yeah, that was actually for me even better. That was, what do we do? So I think I did it for a couple of years, and then the year I won, like the nationals, was in Castle Hill in the on-road track, obviously there under the
Under the
under
shed.
like a sort of shed, yeah, on a concrete track, super slippery, and yeah, we're running the F103 LM chassis or F103 base chassis with the Le Mans bodies. So it probably comes back to my love of Le Mans and Group Cs that that I made that go so fast. So it was the final layer was good. I think the year before, it was F1 bodies, and I was winning, but I think I crashed in the final whilst leading. Yeah, so I crashed out of that one.
I mean, that hurts any time, but when there's a trip to the Worlds on the line, that must have
Well,
stung a little.
it probably turned out better for me in hindsight, of course. But yeah, that was disappointing. And then the year after, I made sure I didn't make any mistakes. So yeah, so it was pretty awesome. And there was the four classes. So yeah, I was in the Le Mans class. And Jake Saab, he won the touring car class. So a lot of you know Jake Saab and Ray Saab, of course. Yep.
I think
And
that's the first time we've heard the Saab name in this podcast series. So, and that would have been right around when Jake was emerging as a genuine front runner on the national scene, wouldn't it?
yeah, he was pretty good. He was pretty young, and obviously very good still. Don't know exactly how old he was, but yeah, pretty young at the time. Yeah, so that was a good win for him, of course. And then, yeah, and Ray, because Jake was so young, Ray obviously came with us to the Worlds as well, to look after his son, of course. And yeah, who else was it? There was Andrew Doré,
Oh,
Plucker,
yep.
Plucker, yeah, good old Plucker, from Canberra. So he won the, I think it was the rally car class. And there was one other class, might have been Mini. The name slips my mind who won that one. Apologies to that person.
You've done well.
So there was the four of us, so the four different classes, and Trevor Johnston came as our team manager. Yep, and his wife Linda.
Linda, I think it was. Yeah, extraordinary race organizers, weren't they? Trevor and Linda did so much in the sport in that kind of from then on through the next, I don't know, 10 or even 15 years. Extraordinary contribution to the sport in Australia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I couldn't even sort of start to measure it or understand it. Yeah,
no,
I
think, that's right.
Yeah, they've been amazing over the many, many years, as you said.
Mm.
Yeah, so we had a big big posse of people. So those guys, yeah, and Ray, of course, coming with us. So, yeah, that was just – that was – this is my favourite experience and trip of all time in RC. You know, Kyosho was amazing. This was just next level again. They looked after us like, you know, absolute rock stars pretty much. You know, they had a chaperone, I guess, for each country's team. So, yeah, he just basically stayed with us, took us around to all the different restaurants, you know, lunch and dinner every day. We went for tours of their factories and racetracks. It was phenomenal. Like, they took us to their headquarters. I think they, jumping ahead a bit, their headquarters, like their main office in Shizuoka, or main, you know, office and factory in Shizuoka. Where they took us on like a sort of private tour through all of their, you know, machined area and design area. We saw all of the CNC machines at the time. We saw the vacuum forming shed. So they just had these huge lineup of vacuum form machines.
Wow.
I think I remember at the time that we sort of, they were showing us this machine and those bodies popping off it. And they had their sort of special three-part molds. It was all like metal molds, I think. But to get the overhangs on their bodies at the time, they had a special mold design where the center section would sort of drop out first after it's, you know, molded itself. And then the two ends would sort of slide inwards and then down. And then it would pop the body out. And they were halfway through showing this. And then I can't remember if it was the chaperone or some other guy came in and sort of talking in Japanese quickly. And then he said, oh, whoops, we probably shouldn't have been showing you this. Let's move on.
Secret business.
Secret school stuff. So, yeah. And, they had all these, was it Formula One cars in the foyer?
Okay.
At the reception at the main headquarters.
Yeah.
So there's I think it was Mika Hakkinen's Lotus. There was I think it was maybe a Nigel Mansell black JPS Lotus as well. Because I think they sponsored a couple of the cars, like Mika Hakkinen's car at the time. They had a big Tamiya sticker on the front of it.
Just what an extraordinary company, Tamiya, and to only very slightly lesser extent, Kyosho. Two companies that, you know, not only kind of the competition side, but that very faithful, detailed replicas of so many iconic race cars and road cars and rally cars and all sorts of things over the years. That attention to detail in building scale models. Very cool to get to go to the factory. How was the race itself?
That was phenomenal. So I was in a big shed, like a bit like our exhibition building here in Melbourne, Jeff's shed, so to speak. They had a big building like that. And one end of it was the racetrack. So I was indoor, obviously, carpet, and quite a big track because the full width of the main hall. And then that was probably less than a quarter of the whole building. And all the rest of it was a huge, you know, set up as a Tamiya fair, like big sort of festival fair. So every one of their products just about was on display. They had little tracks for their, mini four-wheel drive cars, little tank fighting arenas. I shopped there and there was just hundreds and thousands of people, you know, coming through over the week or the weekend.
Amazing. Isn't it amazing how big the sport was globally in that era?
Yeah, we couldn't believe it. So we're racing there and there's, you know, probably, you know, 5 or 10 people deep watching the whole time.
Nerves? What nerves?
Oh, yeah. it was pretty awesome. I remember in my class there was 17 of us, 17 total entrants in the Le Mans class, and we all raced at the same time. So there wasn't separate heats or anything. It was just everybody on the track, just go. And the qualifying was single lap. And we'd do, I can't remember, you know, however many sessions we had, and then the single fastest lap was your qualifying order.
Yep.
And over the 17 cars, there was 0.17, I think it was, covering first to 17th. and I was 0.04 of a second off pole, and I was in fourth place.
That's close. Yeah. That is very close.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. And had super cool. Actually, my car. So I just mentioned about the car. Aaron DeFina and myself built up a car for this event. So it was a lot of the parts that he had. You know, every single option, of course. And we built up this car, and BJ painted the body for me as well.
Okay.
And I've still got the exact car.
Okay.
In the cabinet.
That'd be something that you'd be hanging on to, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I've got rid of most of my stuff, unfortunately, over the years somehow. But that one I've kept just, you know, exactly as it came off the track.
Yeah.
And that sort of pride of place in the cabinet, along with the 956 Rothmans Porsche.
Very nice.
Yeah, so we had that. It was all painted up with sort of kind of my colours, but also with Australian flag stuff on it as well.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. Yeah, so I was qualified fourth, and the final, I think it was just one final. Might have been three, but my memory was just one. And at the start, they're all talking in Japanese on the microphone, and then they did the countdown. And when the buzzer went, I just launched, obviously, and just slammed straight into the back of the second place car in front of me, because nobody else on the grid moved, or most of them didn't move, except for the few of us that either didn't realize what was going on or didn't speak Japanese. Yeah. I cleaned up the guy in front of me, and I broke the front body post off my car. And
oh no!
I can't remember what happened to his. So they waited for a few minutes. So I went and fixed my car, and I think the other guy did the same. And then they sort of started talking in English, saying, "Oh yeah, we're just doing a practice for the countdown siren."
Okay. Yeah, helpful to know.
Yeah,
helpful to know the first time around. Yeah,
beforehand. Yeah,
yeah.
So the race was pretty good. I didn't quite get on the podium, unfortunately. I was really close, but just hung on to the fourth place. So I got the little plaque and the ribbon for fourth place at the Tamir World Cup.
Very nice.
Yeah, that was spectacular, and all the food and the sights in Japan was something I'll never forget for sure.
Great experience. Now we're going along here, folks. So if you're still with us, we might even end up splitting this conversation into a couple of episodes. But there's too many good stories for me to want to interrupt Andrew for us. So for as long as he's prepared to keep talking, we'll kind of keep going. I'm really interested in the kind of IFMA worlds of this era as well. I think 2000, 2002, 2004, the ones that you might have made it to, and some of those races, you know, unearthed some of the absolute standout moments and standout kind of superstars and world champions of the on-road side. So just talk me through a little bit of kind of each of those. 2000, I think, is in Japan, is that right? At Yatabe Arena, the world's over there?
Yeah, Japan, the Yatabe in Tsukuba City.
Mm-hmm.
Probably still is, but at the time, that's like a holy grail one of the holy grails of racing, especially for Japan.
Absolutely.
Was Yatabe Arena, so home of Yokomo and Masami Hirosaka.
Mm.
So, I'm going to claim that I was the first Aussie to go to an on-road IFMA Worlds. If anybody can tell me otherwise, then...
I think maybe 10th scale touring car, but there definitely were Australians who went to the 12th scale Worlds right back in the day, people like Jonathan Borthwick and Barry Corff, back in sort of the early 80s. There's a very famous story about them building a replica track in Brisbane for one of the world championship tracks so that they could practice here before they went, a track that hosted 12th scale and then later on Formula One racing for years afterwards. So I think 10th scale, yes, but I think there were some...
I'll claim the touring car because it was the first.
That's right.
It was the first ever IFMA ISPC, that has to be the first, and maybe
for absolutely. I think you're absolutely right there.
I'll claim that one, cool. But not 12th scale. Yeah, so that event was absolutely insane. So it was all three classes. So, pro 12th scale, Pro 10 and ISTC for the first time ever.
Yep.
And it was 10 days long event.
Oh, that's a decent event.
With no break. No. So, the first 3 days were 12th scale. And then the next 3 days was Pro 10. And then the last 4 days was ISTC. And this is Japan in September, I think. Yeah. So it was mega humid, pretty hot. We're racing from, I don't know, 6, 7 a.m. until probably 6 or 7 p.m. every day.
Yep.
And just absolutely sweating our asses off, covered in ice towels and, you know, drinking water constantly. We're actually probably drinking iced coffee from the vending machine constantly. yeah, and then back to the hotel at night. I remember it was absolute shoebox of a hotel. It was like a sort of literally a plastic box with all of the bathroom molded into it. Just enough room for the bed. You sort of could half open the cupboard before I hit the bed.
Pod motel kind of thing.
I couldn't even stand up in the bathroom because it was, you know, designed for Japanese sort of heights generally. So that was pretty amusing, but we didn't spend much time there anyway. So
what car are you racing by this time, Andrew? Are you into kind of Corolla years by this time? Or?
No, it was just probably the seed of Corolla actually.
Okay.
So I was running. I think I was in a bit of a mess because the FSR was like that company was no longer, and they weren't producing anything, and it was kind of a foam tire based car anyway, so it didn't work very well on rubber tires.
Yeah.
So we're running rubber tires at the stage in Turin Car. And I was probably looking for a car to run, and I wound up with the Yokomo, no idea what it was called. It was a composite molded chassis. MR4, sounds good.
Yeah.
Composite molded chassis with, I think it was one big belt that sort of wound its way through, you know, reverse angles through the center enclosed drivetrain. So I thought, oh, well, it's Yotabi Yokomo world. Yeah, maybe I'll magically get setups from all the Yokomo guys, which didn't happen, of course.
No.
So I was running that, had pretty much no clue how to make rubber tires work at that time because we'd only just gone to it.
Yeah, very new thing.
Yeah, and sort of focused on Pro 10 main anyway. The Turin car was just a kind of a new thing. Obviously trying to do my best, but so I had the. I'm pretty sure it was associated for 12 scale and Pro 10 still. So it would have been a 12 L3 and probably the L3 as well, 10 L3. And by probably, I don't know, fourth or fifth day, I was pretty much exhausted, couldn't focus, couldn't concentrate. It was an absolute mess.
We're back here to the advice offered earlier about getting lots of sleep and looking after yourself to get through this. I mean, 10 days is a marathon by anyone's kind of language, isn't it? So how did it all end up for you at the end of that 10 days?
I think I was probably about mid-pack in all of the classes. I think the touring car was pretty much down the back somewhere.
Yep.
Not mid-pack, but Pro 12 and Pro 10 did okay. Would have been about 40th or 50th out of 100 or so in each class.
So big and event.
It was massive.
Huge event.
Just remember seeing all the heroes because it's the first time I'd seen any of the top guys, like, you know, Masami and Cliff Lett. And I was at
Atsushihara wins the
Atsushihara
part of the event, doesn't he? And that's the first official IFMA world champion. That Yokomo, that MR4.
What's the associated guy's name? Slipped my mind. Not Mark Pervidis.
That's all right. I don't remember.
It's the other associated guy, not like working with Cliff Lett at the time, but it was between him, Masami, and Hara, and they all pretty much had chance of winning. Throughout the three finals.
Yeah.
And the third final, Masami was probably had the best chance in that third final. He was leading, and I don't think I was marshalling, but I was watching from the side, and he just touched the corner dot and rolled his car, and that let Hara through for the championship.
He went so very close on a few occasions, didn't he? But that's one that kind of got away.
That was probably his best chance, and then it eluded the master, unfortunately,
famously
after that
eluded.
For him.
That's right. That is one of the enduring stories of particularly touring car. Through that 2000s was the chase of Masami to try and win a world championship. Obviously there, very close, and then again in Thailand a few years later.
Yeah, he dominated the Pro 10 and Pro 12, that event. He was a different level than the rest.
When he was on, he was unbeatable, wasn't he? Let's skip ahead to 2002. And if my recollection and my notes here of 2002, we're in South Africa, and this is, of course, the famous event for Tamiya and Surikhan taking the championship, and that just most extraordinary race start that, you know, perhaps any of us have ever seen. during one of those finals, which you go find the video. It's worth watching even today. What's your, what's the story of 2002 from your point of view?
Yeah, so this one teamed up with Andrew Abbott and we went over together. We didn't go on the same flight and almost didn't make it to the hotel because we had a monumental car crash on the way from the airport to the hotel.
That's not a good way to start a Worlds campaign.
Yeah, we're in the middle of South Africa, which is not one of the safest areas. It was in Johannesburg as well, which is probably not at the top of the safest cities list.
No.
And in the dark, out in the middle of the country, nowhere, I don't know where I'm going. It's all dark. There's no lights, no street signs. The driver's, driving me to the hotel that I'd hired.
Mm.
And this Mercedes veered onto the other side of the road and basically had a full head on in our combi van.
Oh my gosh.
And I think it did I think the combi van pretty much did a 360 on the spot and then just landed. And I just remember after we kind of landed and everything had stopped, obviously he's kind of in shock. And I looked around for my jacket where my passport was in the pocket.
Yeah.
And it was I had it on my lap and then it was out on the ground next to the car. Like all the windscreen was gone and the doors were all smashed open. And
this was not a story I was expecting when we got into this conversation. That's extraordinary, Andrew.
I haven't told many people this actually.
Yeah.
It's like I remember the seatbelt saved me, obviously. I had a big massive bruise on my left shoulder from the seatbelt. And that was it, no other injuries. That was the best bruise I've ever had.
I mean, a terrible incident, but also it sounds like a lucky escape. Could have been a lot worse.
Could have been absolute horrific. So, just grabbed my jacket with my passport. And then the driver was trapped, his leg was trapped in the car because that's what, that corner of the hit. Yes. The other car hit. Yeah. Yep. The other car was just sideways across the road with, I think the engine was still running. There was just stuff everywhere. It was like pitch black, like nobody around. And then suddenly all these people started appearing out of the dark, just local people living in the country.
Yeah.
Right, just milling around, what's happened? Obviously they heard the noise.
Yeah.
So all these sort of random people just milling around. Obviously I don't understand what the language is and what's going on. And my driver's trapped and the other guy's probably not too well. I don't know if he survived, but another guy stopped and started to help. So he was flagging down cars and with his flashlight, and he started to chat with me and ask me where I was going, etc. So I told him the hotel, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I know where that is, just a bit further up the road." And then the police turned up, and they dragged the other guy out of the Mercedes or whatever it was. So he was on the ground, not looking too flash hot, and then this guy said, "Oh, do you want me to give you a lift?" So I started pulling all my stuff out of this combi van, putting into this random stranger's car in the middle of the pitch black country in South Africa that I'd been in for 2 hours. And I'd left this poor driver guy, which I obviously regret ever since, left him trapped in the car, but there was police and everything by that point.
Emergency services are there,
Yeah, so that was starting to gather and help everyone. But, so I jumped in this guy's car and just fled the scene, basically. And this complete stranger turned out to be a super good Samaritan and not a crazy guy. Took him to the hotel.
Ended well. Could have ended very differently.
Gave me his phone number, said, if you need anything while you're in South Africa. And he's like, "I'm so sorry this happened to you." So give me a call if you need anything. It's like, "Oh my God, thank you.
Wow.
So that was a great start to that Worlds.
There are stories of people's adventures at World Championships, but there are not too many that stack up against that one as being a pretty crazy trip to a Worlds.
That was pretty wild. I remember hearing that Masami and his team got robbed at knife point at that same event.
Yeah.
So it was almost, probably as bad. So they lost all their money and stuff at the time, but luckily weren't injured either.
I think there was an off-road after that Worlds. It got better. I think there was an off-road Worlds in South Africa later on that ended up being largely boycotted by people from many parts of the world.
Yeah,
maybe
I
two
remember that.
thousand nine,
Yeah.
I think. Actually, worth noting that Craig Lawton was on the podium in both two wheel drive and four wheel drive at that world championship. Still the highest placed Australian ever at an off road. Anyway, we're
Wow.
getting distracted, but
Yeah, I
South
do remember
Africa.
that at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a bit scary, but it got massively better after that.
I should hope
So
so.
that was definitely the low light. Yes, yeah, so the rest of the event was great fun. All the locals were super, super friendly and accommodating. It was really nice atmosphere. Great, unbelievable track as well. It was like one of the, at that time, it was a track to the level of which I probably hadn't seen in terms of its, the concrete curbing and the quality of it. It was amazing.
Set a standard for the modern era, didn't it, of racetracks?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it did, because that was really, the standard these days of, well, especially outdoor tracks with all of the curbing is basically up to that standard. You know, the best tracks would be, equivalent to that, I would say.
Yeah.
It was only 12 scale and touring cars by this time. So Pro 10 had been, that was the last one in Japan, last ever world championship for Pro 10. And yeah, so Masami again was, I think it was pretty dominant from memory in 12 scale. I think there was a few, who else would have been, like maybe Andy Moore? Can't remember
who
the
could
other
have been
guys
around.
Were on 12
yeah,
scale.
yeah,
yeah.
Yep.
There's a few guys there that were probably not far off. I think Josh Cyril had a bad run in qualifying, and he was actually in the B final. So I was racing, I think I qualified like 7th or maybe 18th or 19th, and I finished 17th, I think.
Yep.
And I remember being lapped by Josh in the B final. So that was pretty good. Yeah, I was really happy with that result. I mean, there wasn't a massive field at that point in South Africa, but I think it was in the top 50%. It was about 50 or so entries, I think.
Yeah,
so it was pretty cool.
That's nice.
Yeah, and then touring car. But yeah, actually, by this stage, I was running the Corrales.
Yep.
So I think after the Japan Worlds, I met Constant and Yoko in Japan, and pitted with them. And I was the English driver, Andy. I'll just call him Andy because that's a good name.
Yeah.
So yeah, so really good friends with them, and also Simo and Sake Ehanimi.
Mm-hmm.
So I met all them there, and then soon after that, Justin was already driving for Greg Barkler and Ari and Hobby Express.
Yes.
HEI here. Hobby Express, and then so I think after that, I joined up with those guys to start racing the Corrales. So I think Ari was running the very early X-Ray at that point, and then Justin and myself were running the Corrales. And then so in South Africa I was running that. So I was pitting with Constant and Yoko and Andrew Abbott. Andrew Abbott was running Associated, but we're sort of pitting together. So it was pretty cool. So he was an honorary Corrales driver for the for the event. We let him pit nearby us.
I'm sure he was delighted. I'm sure he was.
Yeah. And I think we were, we go all the way there, and I think we were pretty much battling for about 44th and 45th, I think, in touring car.
That is so often the story for Australians, isn't it? They travel to the other side of the world and all end up.
Yep.
I think it was, again, an off-road world that maybe at the X-Ray factory track a couple of years ago, and, there were like three or four Australians in one of the finals together. It basically was like a big club day. The end of a world championships on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Yeah. It is kind of inevitable because, we're all at a similar level. So it's likely to happen, but it is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And remember we raced with Craig Drescher in that heat as well. I think he had a pretty bad qualifying. He shouldn't have been there, of course, but he was in the D final with us. So that was good fun. We actually became pretty good friends with him at that point.
Yeah, good.
Especially Andrew Abbott. Yeah, he was really good mates with Craig.
Hmm. And they would have both been running for Team Associated at that point.
Yes.
That's the base of that relationship. I mean, what's your, do you recall watching that famous start of that final with Surikhan doing what still seems impossible, even if you've watched the video 100 times?
Yep. I don't know why. I'm pretty sure I was marshalling right on that corner.
Okay.
And in the video, you might be able to see the top of my hair in one of the shots.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just saw that literally in front of my eyes, and it was unbelievable. It was as unbelievable as it looks on the video, which I've watched quite a few times since. It was the start of all eternity, I reckon. You'll never see anything better.
Yeah. I mean, it was extraordinary. And I'll try and remember to put a link in the show notes, but if you find YouTube and find Surikhan World Championship 2002. You won't have trouble tracking down. People won't have trouble tracking down that footage.
Yeah, Ray Woods. I think it's the Ray Woods video.
Yes, Ray Woods. It is a Ray Woods video. That's right. Yeah, I spoke to Ray on this podcast about that moment. He saw it all happen through his camera at the time.
Yeah. Yep. He got the perfect footage of it.
Yeah. So 2004 is the other worlds that, and maybe we'll just kind of comment quite briefly on this one, but that in particular is it's in the US. It marks the emergence of Mark Reinhardt at the very front. He wins the world championship, second in a row for Tamiya in touring car. Any kind of comments or thoughts or reflections on that 2004 worlds?
Yeah, so that was Kissimmee in Florida.
Yeah,
that one. Yep. Mm. Yeah. So yeah, went Andrew Abbott again and Matt Griffin as well. He came with us on that one.
Yeah.
I think that was the other. It was in the other Aussies. Ray Wood was Ray Wood there?
I think he must have been there. Yeah, I think he was filming that one.
Check YouTube videos.
I think it was he and his. I think it was his son that was with him doing all the filming for that event. Again, people can dive into the back catalogue of this podcast and listen to the episode where I tried to wrangle Ray Wood down to an hour. but he talked about that event as well. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. That was cool. Next to an old airfield where they were flying like vintage World War II planes out of.
Hmm.
So, yeah, every half hour you'd see like a P-51 Mustang or something taking off. Which was pretty spectacular.
Hard to focus on the racing, man.
Yeah, that was excellent fun. Another big, massive outdoor track. Same again. Masami was actually was challenged in 12th scale, I think, that time. It was he did win it, but it was a lot closer. And then in touring car he was up there battling Reinhardt and Spaschett, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it was pretty close to the top. I mean, it was like four or five guys at least, and Hara, of course, it's Ishihara. And maybe Adachi as well at that one. Shinosuke Adachi. They were all pretty close. So, that was pretty awesome racing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, same again. I think I was racing Matt Griffin in, I think it was about the D final or E final maybe, in our one. And yeah, I think I took him out in one of the races, and we had a big argument about that. Yeah, so
not only traveling to the other side of the world to race against one of your local opponents, but to have an argument on the side of the track as well.
And took him out and pissed him off, and we were not friends after that for quite a while. And then I think eventually it was maybe a Wodonga off road or something we made up, and we're friends again.
And again, for those who've not been in the back catalogue of this podcast, you can go and find an episode where I chat with Matt. Such an extraordinarily talented driver across multiple disciplines. Very good. And really that event did mark the emergence of Mark Reinhardt as a global force, and he continues to be one of the best today.
We just won the 12th scale worlds recently over in England.
Yeah. 2000, I think. 2020,
yeah, that was all a mixed up COVID one that was delayed or something, I think.
And once again, if you're into the back catalogue, I spoke with Robin Schumacher just a couple of weeks ago, and he reflected on that world championship win. Mark doing a sort of special guest one-off appearance for Schumacher as they returned to 12 scale. Andy, let's drag ourselves back to Australia, and we just want to kind of pick apart a couple of other races along the way, and then do want to get to reflecting on the vintage kind of stuff. And this might mark the point at which we put a pause on this episode. And, for those of you who are listening, I'll say thanks for hanging in there with us. We'll be back next week to finish off the Andy Cook story. And make sure you come back, because it is the time of where we'll discuss the GP3D vintage replicas and all sorts of things. So for the conversation to this moment, Andy, thanks for going into all the detail. I'm going to pause for a moment, and then we'll keep going. We'll flick that into next week's episode. So thanks for being with me so far tonight.
Brilliant. Yep. Thank you so much, Scotty. Lots of talking.
Beautiful.